Hello and welcome to End of Life University. This is your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt. I'm so glad you've joined us today, whether you're listening to the live broadcast or to a replay at some later time. And I am happy to have so many listeners coming on to enjoy these interviews and recordings. And I want to thank you for the support that you give to End of Life University by tuning in. Today we have another fascinating conversation for you. My guest today is Pashta Mary Moon. She is a mother and grandmother from Victoria, British Columbia, who spent her youth as a social activist and nonviolence trainer and teaching music in elementary schools. Later, she obtained an honors degree in world religions, followed by a lay seminary degree, which included writing several essays on death practices in our modern culture. In the 1960s, she worked with people living with HIV/AIDS, caretaking for those dying from this disease, as well as officiating at their requiems or memorials. Pashta's background is primarily in pastoral care in chaplaincies, as visiting clergy for hospitals, hospices, and federal prisons. As a singer-songwriter, she has long used vocal music as an alternate therapy to support the dying or grieving process. She was one of the co-founders of the Victoria Hospice Bedside Singers and then created Enchanting Beyond to support dying people, birthing mothers, and people with dementia. Pashta has researched and developed advanced directive templates and participates in a number of different organizations, including the Victoria Elder Friendly Community Network, Canada's Dying with Dignity, and the International End of Life Professionals Collective. Pashta has also studied family-led home funerals with final passages and has over 30 years of experience with developing and leading personalized ceremonies for a variety of different rites of passage. Eventually, she became a death midwife and the co-founder director of CINDIA, which is the Canadian Integrative Network for Death Education and Alternatives. So, Pashta, I want to thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen.
Well, you're very welcome. And after just reading your resume, and I actually left out a number of things, you have spent so many years of your life devoted to work in the end-of-life arena and done so many different things to care for people who are dying at the end of life and also to advance the cause of the end of life. And I was wondering if you would just briefly tell us, Pashta, how you first became interested in working with people at the end of life.
Well, actually, Karen, it started with a movie when I was 7 years old. I was downstairs watching TV when I wasn't supposed to be. And I was watching one of those, you know, the old 50s, quotes, cowboys and Indians movies with the pioneer family going across the West and being attacked by, quotes, Indians, and the father got killed. And the mother had no choice but clean him up, dig a hole, bury him, do her own rites, fill in the grave, and carry on with her children. And at the time, I had this like really very strong feeling that that was the right way to do things. But at 7 years old, I had no idea what that meant or why that struck me or what it could mean in the rest of my life. But from that point on, the whole issue of how we approach death, and particularly the sort of more hands-on level of it, of keeping it closer to our hearts and closer to our hands, became a recurring issue in sort of every decade of my life. It came up in another way. Everything from, you know, going to Shanti Nilaya, which is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's center in my 20s to talk to them about different ideas I had about how what was happening as people were dying, through to actually the 80s when there were, well, AIDS was a death sentence at that point, 6 months to 2 years, and working with a lot of people dying of AIDS. And then on, just on and on through the whole of my life, and actually, interestingly, spending 20 years working primarily with lifers, people with life sentences in federal prison chaplaincy, who actually go through a very similar process as the five stages for death. And sort of noticing that they actually go through that process themselves, even though it's not about dying, but it's about a life sentence. And then eventually, to all the things that you mentioned in terms of my life now.
Well, that's so fascinating, and I'm interested in how it's, you know, I had never thought of it before that a movie made back in the 1950s would actually portray the original green burial and home funeral. I mean, the way it was done in the past, and it's interesting to me that was your inspiration that kind of brought you to this realization over time that's what you were meant to do. And indeed, you have done this work throughout your entire life. So I commend you for that.
Well, thank you. And I think it's interesting, too, you know, that we are exposed to natural death and green burials all the time in movies. We just don't recognize in our modern culture that it's still possible to do it.
Mm-hmm. So that's so true, very true. Well, one of the things that really drew me to you when I read your websites and your profile is the fact that you use bedside singing, and I've never spoken to anyone about doing that before or heard of it, so I was really eager and fascinated to talk to you about it and ask you if you would just, first of all, just explain to us what bedside singing is and how you use that for patients who are in the dying process.
Well, bedside singing is, it is just literally that, singing at the bedside. That particular kind of music, rather than music therapy, in its more professional form, is usually used with people who are closer to the dying process, although I also use it with people who are in dementia. Essentially, you are singing fairly simple songs. Usually they're sort of trance that you repeat over and over again. And, you know, you might sing the actual words three or four times so that I don't like using the word patient, the person, or the term I prefer is the death journeyer. The death journeyer has a sense of what the words and the intent of the chant is about. You do that about three or four times, and then you hum until you feel that the person has journeyed with it as far as they need to within themselves. And you're watching for, you know, clues from their face, their body language, et cetera. So it is, are they actually responding to the song, and have they done whatever inner work they want to do? And sometimes you might hum the music over again for maybe 5 minutes, and sometimes I've done it up to 40 minutes, the same song, just over and over and over again. And it has this kind of, well, I'm sure you know, Karen, that music speaks to us way beyond the intellectual level, way beyond what we call the conscious level. There's lots of evidence that, and certainly I've seen this in my own life working with people with dementia, that they will remember the tune of the song or even the chorus of the song after they have lost all speech. All other speech. If there's something about something that goes way deep inside with music, and it's a way of touching and being present and supporting somebody, especially when they're not able to communicate any longer. And of course, you know, most people, when they're in the process of dying, they're going more and more inward. Their focus is less and less the world around them and more the world inside of them. And so that I think can be a way of being present and supporting them, but still letting them take the journey that they need to do, or the work, do the work that they need to do in their inner world.
I have a question about that. The chants that you use, are those chants, is that music that you had already learned previously that you use, or do you ever kind of ad lib and create it on the spot for the patient?
Most of the time it's chants that I've already learned. There are times, though, when there's a sense. It's really a very intuitive work because you're really picking up on very subtle clues on whether or not this particular music is working for the patient, right? Because most often they are at a point where they can't communicate, or, for example, they're using the music to try and get through anxiety or restlessness or something like that and be able to rest. So, of course, they don't want to pull themselves out to the outside world and communicate. They want to just be very quiet. So sometimes you're watching for very, very subtle clues of how all of this is working for them. And there are times when I would switch the song because I can see that song isn't working, or there's slight indications that something else is really needed. I'll give you an example. I was singing on the hospice unit and to a man who was dying, and all of us, I was holding his hand, and his sister-in-law, I think, was holding his other hand. And all of a sudden, he was really pulling out of my hand, and he turned, and he was pointing up to the corner of the room. And he couldn't say anything, but he just kept sort of pushing his arm to the corner of the room. And my intuition was that he was seeing people welcoming him to, mm-hmm. to cross the threshold. And so at that point, I changed the music right away to a song that is about going home and crossing the threshold, so that I could support what he was envisioning and responding to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's changing the song when you get the indication that something else is needed. And sometimes I will just change the words of the song because I realize from something that their family said or some kind of a reaction to a word in the song that something else is needed. So most of the time I'm singing something that I already know, but you're constantly watching to see what kind of change is needed.
Mm-hmm. So you have to be very tuned in and very present with the journeyer, as you called them, throughout that process, to just responding to the cues they're giving you and then adjusting as you go.
Yeah. And it can be anything. I mean, it can be the flutter of an eye. It can be a change in a breathing pattern. You know, any of those kinds of things.
I can imagine that the bedside singing is not only very comforting for the journeyer, but for the family members who are in attendance, too. I can imagine that it's very soothing and calming for everyone who's in the room.
It is that, Karen, but it also has another aspect to it. I think it's really significant, or I feel it is. When the family is in the room, most of the time there's at least one person who is focused on the deaf journeyer. When a bedside singer is in the room, it's the bedside singer who is usually closest to the deaf journeyer, and perhaps one family member is holding their hand or something. But the rest of the family doesn't have to pay attention to the deaf journeyer themselves. So what often happens is that they will be on, you know, the chair or the couch or whatever else is in the room, and allowing themselves to do their own grieving work. They, you know, kept on a brave face for the death journeyer. Their focus is very outward to the death journeyer and what they need. And the singing helps them actually move into their own world and deal with their own issues. So often I'll find that when I am singing to the death journeyer, I'm also hearing the family in the background crying or comforting one another or, you know, humming along. And I can tell with the humming that they're doing something with the music for themselves. So it's not only peaceful, but it also gives them space to focus on their own inner world and what's going on for them.
Yes, at such an important time, too.
Yeah. And, and you know, I mean, they do have that time to some extent, you know, if they leave the room, but they're often then going about their daily business and having to be, you know, up and functional and not dealing with their grief, et cetera, to do all of their daily functional things. And as I said, when they're in the room with the death journey, they're usually paying attention to that person's needs. So this gives them a little bit of an oasis to just deal with their own needs and not have to do anything else.
Yes, just a little respite in the middle of this journey that's taking place.
Yeah. One of the first days,
Go ahead.
A quick story. One of the first cases that I had in a hospital, you know, aside from people who were dying with AIDS in the 80s, when I was working in a hospital, there was a man who was going into dementia and quite an extreme way. He was dying, and his arms were flailing all over. He could not settle at all. And I knew that he was born-again Christian. I knew the kind of music that his church sang. So I called down to chaplaincy for a hymnal. And I can sight read enough that I can sing the easier songs. So I started singing those songs to him. And as I sang, his hands sort of moved farther and farther down to the bed and moved slower and slower and slower until he was tapping his legs in time to the music. Mm-hmm. And his wife was beside me, and she totally broke down crying because that was the only sign left that he was still there and there was any way of reaching him.
Wow. That's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you if chants are the only type of music that work, but then you just answered that you sang hymns to this man that were reminiscent of, you know, of his earlier faith in his life. So it sounds like you could use a variety of music, especially if someone had music that had been special to them.
Yes. And, I mean, it's really going to depend on the situation. And as we might talk about a little bit later on, if you're using bedside singing for a birthing rather than dying, you're changing your whole repertoire.
Yeah.
most of the repertoire. Not all of it, but most of it. But, yes, you can chant are the best if you don't know the person really, really well. And if the point of the bedside singing in that moment, especially if it is to come into a restful state. Another story on the hospice unit, we were called in for a man who was extremely agitated and restless, and he'd been given meds for it twice, and they weren't working. And so they called us in to see if we could help. And it took us 45 minutes, but at the end of that, he was asleep. And, you know, through that whole period of time, he just very slowly got more and more restful, more and more peaceful, and eventually into a deep sleep. So that's part of what you're, you know, that's often what the goal is. if you really, I mean, really the goal is just to be where the patient is, but that's often where they're going. But, you know, if a patient is also, if a patient is conscious, then they're going to want often some music that is particularly important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it might be a hymn or it might be an old song, but if I happen to know it, I'll sing it, that had been a popular song and it always meant something to them. So, you know, there's a lot of flexibility there. The chants are your sort of mainstay, but as much as you possibly can, you go with, you know, what the deaf journeyer needs at that moment.
Do you feel it's important to have some sort of training in bedside singing, or do you think it's something that anyone could use if they're comfortable, with singing?
I think there's two answers to that, Karen. One is that there are lots of family members and friends who just automatically sing
mm-hmm.
to a friend or family member who's dying. It's intuitive. So that, you know, a lot of people will do it simply because they have some comfort with music, or they happen to know that that particular song was a really important song to the deaf journeyer, and they just do it. In terms of offering that as a service, yes, I do believe that people need some training because, as I said, you know, because you don't know the person, you're having to pick up extremely subtle clues. And being able to read those and also know your own repertoire well enough to know what kind of things would work and wouldn't. For example, if you know that the person, the deaf journeyer, has had some problems with delusion, probably from medication, and they've been doing something. There was actually a case on the hospice unit where there was a man who kept trying to stand up and fly. You don't sing songs about the soul flying away to heaven or wherever, right? You don't sing that because it's just going to reinforce that particular
mm-hmm.
delusion. If you know that the person has a fear of water, you don't sing songs about sailing away across the Western Shore, which, you know, is a pretty common Western world metaphor for dying. So you have to be really careful about what songs you sing, that you're not triggering a fear, a deep-rooted fear that they have,
mm-hmm.
or a delusion. So it's a combination of those two things, of knowing how to read very subtle clues. When you don't know this person, you don't know what their issues are, and then how to adjust, you know, knowing your repertoire well enough that how to adjust so that you're giving them, it's almost, you know, the music's almost like a river that they can travel on to do their own inner work, and you've got to give them the right river.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that this is such a wonderful resource because in hospice we've all been in those situations when the journeyer is experiencing pain or agitation, and when medication is really, you know, more medication is really not the answer. I just think what a beautiful adjunctive therapy to be able to use music, but not just playing music through, you know, through a CD player or something, but to actually be singing so the patient is feeling the vibration of your voice and the movement of the air and the words that you're bringing to them. But it sounds so beautiful.
You're right on, Karen. There is a real distinct difference between, and patients have told us this, that there's a really distinct difference between listening to a CD and having someone actually sing to them. It becomes much more personalized, And, of course, as I said before, you're shifting constantly what you're doing and how you're doing it in response to their response, which a CD can't do.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It reminds me, a guest we had about a month ago told a little story about an African tribe where when a baby is born, and you probably know this, this story, that when a baby is born, the village gathers together and they sing a song, and each person in the village has their own unique song that's given to them at birth, and then that same song is sung for that person at the time of their death. Everyone in the village remembers the song. It's unique mm-hmm. to every person. And then that song is sung, and it just reminds me of that, of just honoring that individual and the uniqueness that they've brought to the world in this lifetime, and sending them off with a beautiful song that matches them, that matches the gift
yeah.
they've brought to the world.
Yeah, and although, I mean, obviously we're not doing that in bedside singing, that specific thing, because we're trying to adjust and find what works best for that person, we're sort of at least honing it down to be more
yes.
personalized. And, the other part of it too, Karen, and, I mean, we've already said this, but I think it's worth repeating, the sense that the person is, especially when they're in the active dying stage, and, you know, you're talking about hours before their last breath, and you're singing. At that point, especially if the person is in a coma, and most of the time they are in a semi-coma, at that point, it is a way of being present, and there is no other way, except on a pure energy level, there's no other way of being just present and holding them as they take that passage.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's beautiful because the singing, it actually is something that you can do at a time when it feels that there's nothing else that can be done. It is
right.
It is something that you can offer.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you can pray and, you know, those sorts of things as well. But, we have this urge to do in our culture.
Yes.
We don't want to just be present, we want to do. And it is a way of doing that doesn't interfere with the journey.
Yes, yes.
That the community is taking.
Yes, that's a very good point. Well, that you've answered my questions about the bedside singing, and I wish that I had known of that when I was working in hospice, since I'm not doing the work myself right now, but I think it's a beautiful resource that I would love for hospice workers and end-of-life workers to know about, to even utilize in their own practices. But you have, in addition to the bedside singing, you've done so much. You've done so much in your career for the end-of-life, so I wanted to cover some of the other things that you have created and put out there. And I noticed it was on the Cindea website, and that's Cindea. Post-death care at home video series. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about that series.
It's five or six videos. I can't remember. They're fairly short, and they're simply demonstrating how you would take care of a body at home. So there's one on how you can transport a body around inside the home just using a sheet. And there's another on washing and how you get the eyes and the mouth to close and then washing the rest of the body and the few little tricks that you need to know to be able to move the body around so that you can wash everything and dressing. And it's a few tricks on how to dress a person who can't help you at all in terms of doing that. And there's also one as well on moving the body into the coffin or choosing a shroud. Our purpose in doing them was to show the general public that taking care of a dead body is, in fact, very simple and for the most part pretty intuitive. It's actually a lot easier than taking care of a live body, and in part because, of course, you can't hurt them anymore. But, you know, a lot of the death taboo is about handling a dead body.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to show that the process of caring for a dead body, the dead body of your loved one at home, is really quite simple, and it's something that is quite easily done. You don't have to have a lot of special training to do it. And the best way to do that, we felt, was to simply, I mean, you know, the person in the videos is not really dead, but he's a really good actor. They're a very good job of acting dead. And in fact, we actually chose somebody who was quite tall. I think he's 6'2", to show that it, you know, it's not just with your very tiny, frail little grandmother that you can do all of this with. A much larger person as well, and just actually do it. Go through the process and show people just how very simple it is, and that it doesn't need to be scary. You know, people still are going to have to get over that edge of this is a dead body now, not a breathing body. Even if they're used to caring for their loved one while they're in a coma, and it is almost as if they are dead because they, you know, they're not interacting and they're not helping. They are, as we, you know, tend to say, a dead weight as we're trying to care for them. But they're still breathing, and somehow that breath makes such a huge difference in terms of, you know, this death taboo we have. So we just wanted to make it sort of. We know that, you know, just watching the videos, is not going to cross that threshold of that fear. But to sort of, sort of help people sort of get a little bit maybe over or question their own ick factor around it.
Yes. Well, I think, too, that it does help people address the fear when they have some knowledge and information, and that one of the barriers for people to preparing a loved one's body at home might just be, but I don't know I don't know how to do it. I don't know what to do. I have no idea what to do. And so I think it's wonderful that you've made these videos available. They're easy to watch and brief and easy to understand. So there's this, it's a tremendous resource. And to be able to recommend these to family members who are contemplating keeping their loved one at home after death, I think it's a fantastic resource, and I'm so impressed that you've made it available on the website so anyone could watch it, and other people could refer family members to your videos to get that just the information and the reassurance that you can do it and you can do it fairly easily, and I think it's very helpful.
Yeah, and then that's actually part of the whole mandate of Scendia was, you know, to let the Canadian public know that there are other options throughout the whole pan-death process, like pan-death being, you know, before, during, after. So the whole process, the whole journey, but particularly that post-death period, you know, the 2 to 4 days before the person is going to be cremated or buried, that they actually have the legal option to keep the body at home, and that it's not that difficult to do. And being aware of the fact, you know, I mean, I'm a death midwife. My work is to support families and guide them through the process. But the reality is that there aren't going to be death midwives or home funeral guides, the term used for people who focus on the post-death period, they are going to be available across Canada in every urban city, never mind any smaller city and small town, for years and years and years to come. and may not ever. You know, I mean, we don't have birth midwives either. In every small town in Canada, and that's even more so because of our demographics. So families who want to look at those kinds of options are often going to be in the position of having to do it on their own. And so part of what Sandhya is trying to do is provide all the information they would need to make that choice to do it on their own. So the videos, and there's a PDF that is on post-death care too that gives a lot more specifics and, you know, all the supplies you need and where to get them. And then there's also a PDF with the general timeline of what needs to be done when, and that includes the required paperwork around medical certificate of death and then the death certificate. And in some provinces, you need a transport permit to be able to take the body from the home to the crematorium or the cemetery. Or in fact, because this is another option, which is legal, is to bring your loved one home from the hospital or the hospice or the residential care facility that they have been in and bring them home after death and take care of their body there. So you need to be able to transport the body. And in some provinces, like BC, you do have to have a special permit to do that. So the general timeline document is, what do you have to do, in what order, at what point, so that people feel like, okay, I've got a list here, and this is what I follow, and I'm not going to run into some legal problem because I didn't do something at the right time.
That's wonderful, and I'm imagining there are probably some differences here in the U.S. depending on what state someone might be located in, but perhaps the general timeline is useful, and people just need to find out the laws for their particular state or any regulations that exist where they live.
Yeah, I mean a lot of the timeline, Karen, is going to be generalized to pretty much everyone in North America. There'll be some specific pieces that may or may not be needed, or may or may not, you know, be in a slightly different order. But for the most part, it's not hugely different in the States. I mean, you have to have somebody pronounce death somewhere along the line. It doesn't have to be immediately after the death, but you do need to do that, and you do need to have a death certificate before there can be a cremation or a burial, and, you know, so those things are going to be common to all North Americans. But you're right. People do need to look into their own specific province or state to find out, you know, if there's any specifics. And part of what also Sandhya does, I mean, there's several pages on just the whole idea of doing this and why it might be valuable and the difference that it makes to grieving and to what I call the community, building the community of grieving within the family and friends, which I think is really, really significant, because when the body leaves the house, the tendency is for people to grieve on their own, not together. When the body is in the house and they're going about taking care of it and their daily tasks over a 3 or 4 day period, they are more likely to grieve with each other. And then they build permission to grieve with each other in the years to come. I think that that's really, really significant in the grieving process.
That's very interesting.
And the other thing is that I think it's really important for caregivers as well, because I'm getting into the reasons for doing post-death care now, but I would just say that you know, if you have been the caregiver, especially if it's, you know, been more than a couple of weeks, but if it's been months or even years, and you've, you know, had to pretty much change your life to be there 24/7, when the body goes to the funeral home, all of a sudden your role disappears, but you're kind of in the Netherlands. And keeping the body at home for several days allows you, one, to have one final act of caregiving, because you never know what the final act is, because you don't know when the last breath will be. But if you take care of the body afterwards, you always have a last a sense of closure on your own caregiving role. And you also have several days to start processing yourself out of that role without it being a jarring thing. And I think that's really important to the people who've been the primary caregivers.
Oh, yes, that makes so much sense. It creates a much more gradual transition for the caregiver as their role is changing.
Yeah, as well as the rest of the family having a chance to actually come, and including the children, having a chance to actually come to a real emotional, innate recognition of the reality of the death. Because when the body is removed an hour or so after the death, it's still all very theoretical. It hasn't gone through the emotional, the soul level yet. And if the body is kept at home, then that process is very gradual, but it's much more tactile and real. And there's a process of sort of gently letting go of and recognizing that the person that you loved is no longer inhabiting that body.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was also going to say is that there's a whole other section of the Scindia website, which is resource links and it's sort of divided into several pages, but the two major ones are pre-death and post-death. So what we're trying to do is give families the links that they need to the kind of support systems that they would use all the way through the pre-death period and then all the way through the post-death period. And part of the post-death page is the specific laws and regulations and certificates for each province and territory. So you're able to, you know, take that general guideline and then go to your own province that, you know, happens to be Saskatchewan and find out, this is a site for Canadians, so I've only done provinces, but, you know, go to Saskatchewan, find out what pieces of paperwork do I actually need and where do I get them.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's really a fantastic resource. So you really have covered what you've described as the pan-death continuum, before, during, and after death. You have resources to cover all of that on your website. And I wanted to just mention to the listeners how to find your website. The web address is scindia.ca, and Scindia is spelled CINDEA.ca. And I think if people just go to that website and kind of browse around, they'll be able to find the resource page and the videos fairly easily. It seems like I was able to find those.
Yeah, one of the things that we have done in formatting, Karen, is to put in, on each page, we put in a mini menu so that people can jump. They know all that's on that page, and they can jump to the specific of what they need. So, you know, there's a general menu on the left side, but each time you go to a page, it tells you exactly what's covered in that page.
Oh, that's fantastic. Because it's full of resources, there's a lot of information there, so that's really helpful to help people navigate through all the information that's there.
Yeah. And, you know, when we first started building Scindia, it came out of me researching from my own death midwifery practice, what resources do I need? And I kept coming across resources for other provinces. So I stuck them in a document somewhere and said, somebody's going to need that at some day. When we created Scindia, what we tried to do is sort of fill that all out. So as you said, you know, that all the major resources in the PANDEF continuum are there. so that it's easy. It's kind of like, you know, a one-stop shop kind of
yes.
thing, that Canadian families can go to the site and find all the resources that they would need. And, you know, so if we put a link into family caregiving services, we give the specific link that has where the family caregiving resources are in that province, or you know, for all the provinces, so that it's easy for them to access that resource in their area. So
that's wonderful.
As you said, and trying to make it really easy to navigate and to find all of the resources, the basic resources that you would need on the one site.
And Pasha, I know that you have other websites as well, because you have produced such an impressive body of work here with all of the different aspects of end-of-life care you've been involved in. So let's see, if you want to tell our listeners about your other websites, is it the Beyonds website?
There's three Beyond websites. That's why the basic URL is Beyond with an F on it, .ca. One of them is Journeying Beyond, which is my death midwifery practice, and I also do advanced care planning consulting. Another is called Enchanting Beyond, which is the bedside singing services, which is primarily for people who are dying, but I have also done it for women who are birthing. So mm-hmm. I use music and bedside singing as part of birth coaching. And the other one is Emerging Beyond, which focuses on mediation, because that's one of the things that I've trained in, is as a mediator. And so I have done family and couple mediation, although my focus right now is more helping families who are, well, I'm sure you know, Karen, that when someone is dying, the family either just puts all the baggage aside and really pulls together, or all the baggage gets triggered and comes out.
Yes.
And it sort of seems to be one of the extremes. So that's more where my focus of mediation right now is, trying to help families deal with the kind of baggage that comes out around a death.
Well, it seems to me, Pasha, that you yourself are a pan-death provider. You have such diverse skills and experience in so many different areas, and that you yourself are a wonderful resource if someone needs more information or needs to know something or has questions. I think that you would be a fantastic person for them to come to just to connect with, because of all these years of experience that you have.
Well, I'm certainly willing to, and quite happy for people to contact me through any of the websites, whether it's the Cyndia one or the Beyonds one, which are my more personal ones. I just feel that it is so important. And there are, in fact, so many incredible resources out there. And but they're not necessarily easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't know what the right word is. You know, they may intuitively feel, with the bedside singing, they intuitively feel to sing to you, you know, my grandma, she dies, makes sense to me, but I don't know if there's anybody else who does that and what it would be called, right? So sometimes, you know, when people contact me, I'm just giving them the right words, you know,
mm-hmm. yes.
what they're looking for, you know, just. But certainly in terms of, you know, questions a family has, I'm quite happy to answer those. And then through Cyndia, I do a lot of supporting people who want to do this kind of work, and where do they train, and how do they package together the, you know, the experience and the training for the specific part of the death process they want to do, or if they want to actually offer services pan-death, which is what Cynthia defines a death midwife as, is paralleling a birth midwife, that it is pan-death as it is pan-birth with a birth midwife. Sort of how do you pull all of those pieces together into, you know, a really solid service for families. So, I mean, I'm very happy to do that.
So if someone wanted to contact you, is the best place to start the Cyndia website and to send you an email through the Cyndia website? Would that be?
That would be perfectly fine, Karen. In fact, all of the contact us links on all the sites will go to my personal email address. So it doesn't really matter which one you use.
Okay.
But I think it's easier for people to find the Cyndia site and use it.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, I'll just summarize for our listeners that we've been speaking with Pashta Merrymoon, and she's the founder of Cyndia, the Canadian Integrative Network for Death Education and Alternatives. And so the website is cyndia.ca, C-I-N-D-E-A.ca. And so you can find out information there about Pashta's work. But remember, the bedside singing, which she does, that's found on the Enchanting Beyond website through beyonds.ca. If you're interested in learning more about bedside singing. So, Pashta, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be here today and have this conversation with me.
You're very welcome, Karen, and I really appreciate a chance, and especially as a Canadian, a chance to sort of share what's happening in Canada with the End of Life University and all of your listeners.
Well, thank you so much, and I want to go beyond that and just thank you for this entire lifetime of work that you have dedicated yourself to, and I recognize what a calling it has been ever since you were 7 years old, and I'm so appreciative of you for answering the call and doing this work and spreading the word and helping so many people.
Thank you so much, Karen. And I'm really excited about what you're doing and the End of Life University is doing. I think we're all working towards our whole culture having a much healthier and healing approach to death. And I'm really excited about all the different ways that that's happening.
Yes, yes, definitely. Well, thank you again to Pashta Merrymoon for being here with us today, and thank you to all of you who are listening. I really appreciate your support and the time that you take to listen to our interviews. And so for today, I will say goodbye, but remember there are new interviews posted the second and fourth Thursday of every month. So be sure to stay tuned and come back for the next interview in a couple of weeks. Thank you and goodbye.